And I'm hoping that as part of this presentation that that will come in some way. But regardless, I'd like to welcome Eben Moglen.
So let me begin then by talking about the copyleft, not in the lawyer's form, as a hack played with copyright law for the purpose of making less copyright law go further, but rather from the point of view of people studying what the software business has been in the past and what it is becoming now. The software business, that is the business of making money by writing good software and delivering it to customers, began, after all, as free lunch, as the saloon keeper's friend. Free lunch, as you recall, is what you give away in order to get people to buy the beer. And software in the business culture of the United States and the world was in the beginning stuff you give away in order to get people to buy the hardware. Software as free lunch was the basic reason that software got good, because it needed to be good to the extent that there was competition in the hardware market. Software was how to differentiate competitive products. And in the first epoch of the computer business in the United States and the world, we got pretty good software out of the process of making better and better free lunch. The saloon keepers actually did compete. There was a lot of complaining about how one dominant saloon had basically all the customers. But IBM found itself in need of competing, if not against other manufacturers of mainframe hardware, then against other ways of doing business that didn't require the purchase of expensive hardware from IBM. And software was a way of making hardware sell. And the quality of software was measured not only by the extent to which it looked good in demo, but also the extent to which it helped hardware to integrate into business process and helped customers make money. From the point of view of the dominant supplier of hardware in the 1960s and 1970s, software was therefore good free lunch, effective free lunch that sold beer, to the extent that customers could see that it integrated that hardware into their business process, cut their costs, and made money for them. The result was that it was important to capture user innovation in the software. It was important for users to be able to understand what software was and wasn't doing for them, to be able to understand how it did and didn't work. And because the skill level of the users of mainframe software was high, there was, after all, a whole layer of skilled engineering talent around the mainframe that didn't belong to the mainframe's supplier but belonged instead to the mainframe customer, there were lots of talented users whose innovations mattered. There are many people in this room who remember that world. They probably feel like fossils most of the time these days. I certainly do. But I, too, was part of that world. When I went to work as a developer of APL interpreters for IBM in the summer of 1979, I went to work on 400,000 lines of 370 assembler, which I understood rather less well than the most sophisticated of the customers, who understood it very well indeed. And when they had an APAR, when they had an authorized problem report to submit, they submitted a patch along with it. And then the SEs and I, as the developer, puzzled over whether this patch submitted by the customer was a good patch or a very good patch or only looked like a pretty good patch. And then we decided what to do about it. But a great deal of the effort expended in the development of software was expended by users fixing bugs and offering, suggesting, nay, damn well demanding enhancements. That was, in other words, an environment in which the saloon keeper was making free lunch in order to sell beer, and the customers were helping to improve the food. The food got better. It got much better. If you think about the development curve of software from the point of view of the measurements of quality we used to apply, like reliability, robustness, fitness for use in tailored circumstances, adaptability, maintainability. Software climbed the curve of quality between 1960 and 1980 very sharply. But if you ask yourself how much better software has gotten over the last 25 years as opposed to changes in the quality of hardware, the story will be much less satisfactory. From the measurements that we applied to quality, robustness, strength in use, reliability, availability for modification and customization, maintainability, there is every reason to argue that the leading products produced by the leading manufacturer are a major step backward. It is arguable that overhaul, given that 90% of the world is still using the software produced by the monopolist, software has deteriorated drastically in the last 25 years in quality. In other words, it turns out that free lunch bore a surprising relationship to high quality and high levels of innovation. At any rate, it's surprising if you're full to the gills with the doctrine that has been preached in the last 25 years about how user innovation is not important, user access to software's innards is not worthwhile, users have no role to play in making fixes or suggesting enhancements except at the level of participation in focus groups, etc., etc., etc. So when, as Matt says, I find myself addressing the question here or elsewhere whether what we do in making knowledge free is for the tradition of American inventiveness or against, it seems obvious to me that the answer is for. American inventiveness has always been about the little guy's inventiveness, about the better mousetrap being inventable by everybody, about the idea that the single skilled craftsman operating on the basis of shared knowledge about the trade now might at any given moment come up with a significant innovation beneficial to everybody, which he ought to be encouraged by law to share and disseminate. The 18th century model of how to encourage the sharing and dissemination of that innovation worked very well under 18th century conditions, arguably worked very well under 19th century conditions, began to work less well under 20th century conditions, and has no significant role in increasing innovation under 21st century conditions. That's not surprising. As a historian of law, it does not surprise me that the techniques for achieving a particular social outcome 400 years ago are no longer the ideal social techniques for achieving the same social outcome now.